Welcome to the Melanin Talk podcast. If you enjoy what you hear today, be sure to send us a message, an email. You can visit our website, melanintalk.com, or our Facebook page, facebook.com/melanintalk. Well, let's dive in to what we have today.
Hey guys, if you've been following our site and our social media, you know that last year we started the Raising Global Leaders series. This is a series of interviews from experts in their fields that talk about leadership qualities we should instill in our children today to make them the leaders of tomorrow. These are those interviews. Tune in and enjoy.
Thank you for joining us here today on Raising Global Leaders. Today, I have the pleasure of interviewing Dr. Karel Kanoy. She is an emotional intelligence expert. She's a managing partner at Developmental Associates, and she's the author of Everything Parents Guide to Emotional Intelligence in Children. Thank you for allowing me to interview you today.
I'm happy to be here. Thank you.
So I have to ask, what made you get into emotional intelligence?
That's a great question, and it's a little bit of a story, so I'll try to make it short. I was teaching the first ever psychology capstone seminar to our undergraduates in the psychology major at Peace College, and since it was a new course, it was up to me what to teach, and so I decided to look at what employers thought for recent graduates, and to my satisfaction, they thought they were pretty good writers and speakers, all the things we teach in an academic environment, but they also said they don't work well in teams, they don't handle conflict well, they don't take initiative, they get stressed out very easily, and I had just read Daniel Goleman's book, Emotional Intelligence. And I thought, wow, these employers are saying these students lack emotional intelligence. So I decided that would be the topic. And 3 weeks into the class, one of the students who always made A's but would argue with me if she made a 96 about the 4 points she missed rather than celebrating the 96 she made. And she would take over team projects because she was scared other people wouldn't meet her standards. And 3 weeks into the class, she's frantically trying to get my attention, and she says, "Dr. Kanoy, why has no one taught us this in school before? I really need this." And it led to the rest of the class talking about, A, how they were already applying it in very helpful ways, like in their job searches and with family members and things like that. But it also led to a very vibrant discussion the rest of class about why schools don't teach emotional intelligence. And so that's how I got started. After that, I started doing my own research with college students, making presentations.
And awesome. Well, I have a student like that. I'm a homeschool mom. And my oldest is very focused on being perfect. And so I'm trying to teach her that it's okay to make mistakes. It's okay to, not be perfect at everything. It gives us an opportunity to grow. How do you suggest that we handle our children and our students when they set high and almost impossible standards for themselves sometimes?
Right. Well, there's two things involved in that. One is an EI skill we call reality testing. And so helping them understand the difference between challenging and beyond reasonable is important. I worked with a head of school one time who set a goal to eradicate illiteracy in his neighborhood in 5 years. And while that was an incredibly admirable goal, it was a bit unrealistic. And so his board had him scale that back to something that was more realistic. I think the other thing that's really important for me to do is to acknowledge the mistakes they make. Tell stories about the mistakes you made. Feel like if they're not the winner or didn't make the highest grade, that somehow that's bad. And that is absolutely not bad.
Right. Okay, so what can you talk a little bit about how academic success and emotional intelligence don't necessarily go hand in hand? Just like with the student you were talking about, and I noticed this in my daughter as well, what should we expect in terms of their intelligence versus their emotional intelligence?
There's absolutely no correlation or no relationships between high in intelligence and low in emotional intelligence. You can be very high in both. You can be low in both. And it is a myth that all gifted students are low in emotional intelligence. So that is not true. Some of them would be low, some of them would be average, and some of them would be quite high. But there is absolutely no relationship, and that's why we need to actively teach emotional intelligence in whatever settings that children exist in so that they have the opportunity to learn these skills.
Okay. So for the whole first half of that, I couldn't hear you.
Oh, I'm sorry. Okay. So we'll do it again. So there's absolutely no correlation or relationship in the scientific literature between IQ and emotional intelligence. Mm-hmm. So someone could be high in both. They could be low in both. They could be very high in what we call book intelligence and very low in emotional intelligence. And a good example of that, unfortunately, is the actor Charlie Sheen, who has an IQ, a very high IQ, over 150, but who has made significant emotional intelligence mistakes and has landed himself in significant trouble because of that.
Yeah, that's a really good example. I think that everybody knows who he is and everybody has seen it play out on the public stage. That's a perfect example. So what about kids that are low performing? Like, how do we motivate them using emotional intelligence to perform at a higher level academically? Can emotional intelligence be used that way?
Absolutely. I think we first have to find out if the teacher or the person working with the child has to use their own emotional intelligence, which would be then to ask open-ended questions to determine why the child is not performing. Maybe they're bored. Maybe they don't see the relevance. Maybe there are things going on at home that have the child preoccupied. And empathy is an emotional intelligence skill. And a lot of people think empathy means you have to agree with somebody or be sympathetic. And really what it means is that you strive to understand their perspective. And so we have to ask children, not why are you not performing well, but ask them questions that would uncover the answer to that. And then go from there. Maybe it's a child that is completely bored at school. And how can you increase that child's engagement? What needs to be different for that child? Maybe there are major stressors going on at home and that child needs some stress management and some coping skills. So I think you first have to start at ground zero with what's behind the problem. Because that is fundamental to then helping that child. But yes, emotional intelligence involves a set of skills that can be learned.
Absolutely. Can you share with us what the components of emotional intelligence are?
The model I use, which was originally developed in a dissertation research by Reuven Baron, now is published by MultiHealth Systems. That model has 15 different skill areas. So I can list all 15 if you Whoa. Want me to, but I'll highlight just a couple that we've already talked about the importance of self-regard. Children need to have self-actualization, which is a desire to learn and grow. And that can be learning and growing through, you know, Girl Scouts or as a member of the soccer team, but you have to have passion for something and want to do that something well. And hopefully we can instill that in children with their academic work, certainly. But a lot of children find their own passions. And I think when we try to make them have a certain passion as adults, it backfires. another one, we've already talked a little bit about empathy. I think one that's very important for children to learn early is assertiveness. A lot of people misunderstand assertiveness and think that if you're assertive at too high a level, that makes you aggressive. And that is not true. Aggression is always results in someone else being hurt emotionally, physically, socially, mentally. Assertiveness is the effort to take up for yourself by setting a boundary, not letting another child take advantage of you, or standing up to a bully in an appropriate, constructive way. So assertiveness never involves harm to someone else. It involves stating an opinion that you believe in or setting a boundary that needs to be set. And that a lot of families misunderstand assertiveness. A lot of families also believe that maybe children shouldn't be assertive, but it's hard to then start learning it suddenly as a teenager if you haven't been taught it earlier in your life.
Right. So along that vein, I think that's a really important point that you made, is a lot of parents and even some educators feel like, especially with the lower age students, they shouldn't be assertive. They should be more placid and respectful. But how can we be intentional about increasing their assertiveness and also making sure that we're setting safe and appropriate social boundaries?
Wow. Okay. So I'll take part one first, and then if I forget part two, you can remind me. So one thing to say, I've lost your... Okay. First of all, being assertive would be completely done in a respectful way. And so adults who might misunderstand if a child is assertive, they're not being respectful, need to be educated themselves. And what would that sound like? So if a teacher, for example, tries to make a child put on a coat, a heavy winter coat, to go out to recess, and the child says, you know, an assertive response by the child might be, I don't want that coat, or I don't need that coat. And a lot of adults would think that they do, because, well, the temperature outside is like 50. Well, if the child gets cold, maybe they can go back inside and get that coat. But to tell the child that they can't state an opinion about whether or not they need to wear a coat, it teaches them that their feelings, their thoughts, their beliefs don't matter. And so very simple things. I think it's important to distinguish areas where children should have a say. It's not okay for a child to say, I'm not going to eat that, you know, chicken for dinner. I'd rather you make me a hot dog. That's not assertiveness. That's letting the child dictate to the parent.
Right.
So there is a fine line sometimes, and the more familiar people become with what assertiveness means and that it's a very healthy and helpful skill for all of us to have, the better off.
Absolutely. I agree 100%.
And then you talked about setting social boundaries. Assertiveness, the literature is very clear that bullies would bully less frequently if A, the victim would stand up to the bullying by saying something like, I'm not willing to be picked on, I'm leaving right now. And whether that's to leave and go to a safer part of the playground where maybe a teacher right. can see what's going on, whatever. I mean, children need to be instructed into how to get into a safe space and away from a bully. But the first thing they have to do is stand up verbally to the bully. Bystanders also need to be taught, instead of watching, or ignoring it, being aware of it, but ignoring it because you don't want the bully to turn on you. Children can be taught simple things like, you know, hey, stop teasing Billy. It hurts his feelings.
Right.
And so there are many, many programs out there about how to teach children to be assertive when bullying occurs. And that's very very important thing for children to know.
Along the same vein of bystanders and children learning how to be assertive, we notice that with our children, they're having a hard time with face-to-face interactions, especially if they involve conflict. So how can we use emotional intelligence to encourage them to deal with those face-to-face interactions?
Assertiveness is more about, instead of confrontation, it's more about providing clarity and setting boundaries. And so when you say to somebody else, I'm not willing to be screamed at, you're not confronting them, you're setting a boundary. And you're providing clarity about what's acceptable to you and not. And so I think parents first have to get comfortable that there cannot be a double standard. If you say that assertiveness is okay, then assertiveness has to be okay when the children are being assertive with the parents. And so if the child provides clarity that they really don't like soccer and they don't want to be forced to play soccer just because the parents want them to play soccer, then that's a good thing. The parent, as we did with our children, can say, look, you have to be involved in two extracurricular activities. One of them has to be civic related, like Girl Scouts, Boy Scouts, a church youth group, whatever, and the other one is your choice. But obviously sports are an easy one for most kids. And so our kids, you know, weren't forced to play a sport they didn't like. And as a result of that, our son on his own found swimming and became a college level swimmer. Went to college on a swimming scholarship. And so, you know, I think it's really important for parents to allow assertiveness at home, to model assertiveness as opposed to aggression in their interactions with other people. A lot of adults out there are aggressive and don't know how to be appropriately assertive. And there's also a lot of passive aggressiveness out there where we don't return a phone call or a text message to somebody we're mad at, because we want to send them a message. Well, that's aggressive, but it's being aggressive in a more inactive or passive way.
Right, absolutely. And I think that you hit the nail on the head when you said that we as parents really need to model this. And I think that's the same for educators and community leaders as well. Can you talk about the importance of self-efficacy and how we can encourage it?
Well, to gain self-efficacy, you have to have success, right? The belief, I can do this. Mm-hmm. So I talk about scaffolding experiences, and I'll use an analogy of learning to ski. When you learn to snow ski, you don't go to the most difficult slope first. You go to the beginner slope, mm-hmm. Or when you're learning to play tennis, you don't play against somebody that can blast the ball by you at 100 miles an hour. You hit softer balls closer to the net, and that you get success at that level, and then you up the challenge, and then you get success at another level, and you up the challenge. And I think for children, part of it is adults being good at knowing what level this child currently is at, and where do we need to take this child by what level of challenge. So the first key to self-efficacy is, past success builds a sense of self-efficacy.
In order to encourage self-efficacy, they have to have some level of success. And we can use the scaffolding analogy. Can you go through that again?
Well, scaffolding just means you increase the level of challenge. think of if you're building a tall building, at first the scaffolding is not doesn't need to be very high because you're building the second or third floor, but then you get that floor accomplished and you go up and up and up. And so with children, you're going up in the challenge level. And so you're taking them through a series of steps. To like a three-year-old, you wouldn't expect to sit still for hardly more than a minute or two. But a 10-year-old should be able to sit still for, you know, 20 to 30 minutes, you know. And so those kinds of parents need to have appropriate expectations and teachers. And then you can scaffold the experiences so that children are successful, because you cannot have self-efficacy if you haven't been successful and don't have confidence.
Right. I agree. I think that in this day and age where everything is so filtered, there's a lot of pressure on parents that we feel to be perfect, to have perfect kids and to have the perfect response and to do everything without any flaw or blemish. Everything needs to be social media worthy, right?
Right.
So how can we... can you talk to us about the importance of letting our children see our faults and letting our children see us be real and authentic and not our filtered selves?
What do you mean by a filtered self? Give me an example of what you mean by that.
For example, never being upset. Something might happen. I had a discussion with my daughter the other day. We went to an event. We were out all day. She was so excited. And then we came home and she wanted ice cream. And I said, no, it's time for us to wind down. Your sister needs a nap. No ice cream right now. And she's like, you're the worst mom ever. And my filtered self would say, okay, calm down. You know, we just need to talk about this. But what I ended up actually doing is I was so tired and bogged down with all this stuff. Now I'm 7 months pregnant. At the time I was 5 months pregnant. I just started crying. And she's like, oh my gosh, mom has feelings. And I was like, I'm trying so hard, you guys. I just want you guys to have a good life. I'm trying to do these things for you. But part of my job is to tell you no. And you don't get ice cream just because you want to. And I struggled back and forth with, you know, was that the best answer? Maybe I should have held it together and, you know, kept that away from her. But then my mother was like, no, she needed to see that. She needs to know you're human.
Absolutely. I agree. And whether you cried or not, you could have said, looked her in the eye, bent down and said, you know, my feelings were hurt when you said that. I have feelings too, and what you said hurt my feelings because I'm trying to be a good mom, and sometimes I have to say no to you. And so absolutely, I think if you mean by filtered, we have to always be sort of unemotional and flat, and I think it's important to be calm but not unemotional. I think it's fine to, in fact, an emotional intelligence skill is called emotional expression. And this is largely about sharing our feelings in constructive, appropriate ways. And that doesn't mean screaming at somebody is okay. It doesn't mean, other forms of inappropriate expression of emotion are okay. But it does mean if you get your feelings hurt, you can tell somebody, I was hurt when you said that.
Yeah.
Or that made mommy sad. And that is very important because children do need to understand there are consequences for their actions.
Absolutely. What do you think is the most important component of emotional intelligence that we should teach our children?
Well, there's no way I could pick one because, like I said, they're 15. And what we know is that they work together. Mm-hmm. I do think in this world there's a lot of empathy missing in children. for other children, for other people. Before 5 years of age, empathy really isn't cognitively possible at very high levels. Like if you fall down and cut yourself, your three-year-old may come and, you know, try to put a Band-Aid on it, which is a form of empathy. But you know, the more sophisticated forms of empathy, understanding that somebody can have a different perspective than I do. They can look differently than I look. Mm-hmm. They can have a different religion. They can dress differently. And they could still be a wonderful human being. And somebody that I could be best friends with if I just gave them a chance. That kind of just the willingness to get to know people and to have open conversations and to not reject somebody because they have a different belief about X, Y, or Z. I think we largely don't do a good job of teaching children empathy. And because of that, they have this sense that their perspective is always better or right. And I was stunned. I'll give you an example with college students when I was teaching developmental psychology, and I was teaching about the idea of parents co-sleeping with their newborn infants and going over the research on that. The students went, "Ooh, who would do that? That's like, that's weird, or, you know, that's dangerous, or that's," and I said, "Wait a minute, where did all this come from?" And, well, nobody I've ever known co-sleeps with their infants. Nobody in my family, nobody, you know, I don't know anybody that's done it. And I said, "Well, does that make it wrong?" And I said, "You know, why do so many people across the world do it? And with good outcomes for the infant, if it's wrong or weird or bad?" And, you know, I was just stunned at their unwillingness to hear the research on it because they didn't have personal experience with it. And therefore, not everybody in the class, but enough of them that it was very startling to me.
Yeah, that's really interesting. And that also points to the importance of exposing our kids to as many different kinds of people and cultures. When it comes to emotional intelligence, you've been doing this work for a long time. What inspires you? What is the thing that keeps you engaged in emotional intelligence and teaching it and going around the world talking about it?
I guess two things. One, the people. When I have somebody come up to me and say, "This changed my leadership effectiveness," or "This changed how I parent," or "I am so much more effective at X now." And I do get that feedback because, and it's not about me, it's about these skills and how valuable they are and how we don't learn them in the school system. So if parents aren't actively teaching them effectively, then children are, it's a hit and miss thing. The second thing that keeps inspiring me is all the research out there about the benefits of higher emotional intelligence for better health, better relationships, better performance in school, more leadership effectiveness, you name it. The outcomes are very positive.
Yeah, that's awesome. Okay, and then lastly, what are some things that you are working on now, and how can we connect with you? How can we find you?
The easiest way to find me is through my website, which is developmentalassociates.com, and or search by my name. Right now, I'm not working on any particular books or curricula or that kind of thing. I have developed curricula for middle schools to use to teach emotional intelligence. I already have curricula out there that can be used with high school students. The book about how to parent can be used by parents. Right now, mostly what I'm doing is working with adult leaders and organizations to help people learn emotional intelligence.
That's awesome. Thank you. And I'll make sure that I include all of your links as well, so you can just click a link and go straight to her website. All right. So, Dr. Correll, thank you so much for allowing me to interview you today. I really appreciate you taking the time through all of our craziness to get together. And I hope you have a wonderful rest of your week.
Well, thank you. And I think what you're doing is very important. So good for you.